welcome to our panel. Let's meet our panelists. Starting with the guy in red. Put me on the spot.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm a professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York. I teach courses in fantasy, science fiction, creative writing, and others. Also an author, first novel, work of epic fantasy called The Third Sign, came out a few years ago. Short stories in various places. I share one of Tim's publishers in that Silence in the Library published anthologies that we both appeared in. And Silence in the Library is also publishing, as at least one person in the room knows, my graphic novel Icarus, which is based on my second novel that will be coming out later this year. I have incredibly exciting news about my third novel that I can't share. I want to talk about it, but I can't. But anyway, the other hat I wear is that I run a podcast called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, along with co-host Brad Bollier, also a speculative fiction author, that interviews and talks about the work of authors, artists, and editors from all over the place. People like Kish Johnson and N.K. Jemisin and Brandon Sanderson and Pat Rothfuss and Ann Leckie and a whole bunch of others. We are in the midst of a triptych on Cameron Hurley's The Mirror Empire at the moment. And if you want to know more about that, you can check it out at speculatesf.com.
At the end of the table.
Thank you, sir. I'm Mike McPhail. I'm a member of the Military Writers Society of America. I'm best known as the editor of the award-winning military science fiction anthology series, Defending the Future. I'm a reviewer for millsci-fi.com, and this year I became co-owner of eSpec Books.
To my left.
I'm Timothy Zahn. I write mostly about war, not so much about peace, but usually the people in my war things don't really want to have war, so I got it covered.
And I'm David Mack. I'm the author of more than 25 novels, a lot of them for Star Trek, which deals with war, but also with the struggle to bring peace out of war. I've also written for the Star Trek Deep Space Nine TV series back in the 90s. Among many other things, and I have a new trilogy that I'm working on for Tor Books, the first book of which is set during World War II and is a fantasy, so hence...
What are the fantasy elements?
Basically, it's Commando Wizards in World War II. Hitler had his occult black magic team working for him, so the Allies decided to recruit their own team of black magicians. Okay. However, as usual, the Nazis are far ahead, have many more people than we do, and all the advantages.
I assume that actually happened, no?
It's actually secret history. It's not all history.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, the idea is that this is what actually happened behind the scenes.
Right, sure. Different dirty dozen.
It was the OSSS, right? The Office of Strategic
Strategic Sorcery, yes.
Just a question to that curiosity. Is it a alternate history type of thing, or is this stuff going on radar so that...
It's secret history, not alternate.
Okay.
The idea is that I'm
hidden.
Yeah, I'm blending it into the real world, events in the real world. Like, for instance, in the first book that I'm working on right now, I went back and did extensive research into the chronology of World War II. And I folded in lots of real elements. Like, there's a scene near the beginning of the book when the main character and his parents are on a ship that is torpedoed and sunk as it's leaving Liverpool at the beginning of the war. That ship is the SS Athenia, which in real life was the first ship sunk by the Nazis at the beginning of World War II. The Nazis claimed it was a mistake. They mistook it for an armed merchant freighter. In the story, it turns out the real reason they sank it is because somebody they needed to get rid of was on that ship.
It actually was carrying munitions, wasn't it?
There's no proof of that.
Okay, but that is the speculative.
Magical munitions.
Yeah. It was actually also carrying a lot of people who were fleeing England at the beginning of the war, including 300 Americans.
So are the British sorcerers going to suppress curiosity, whatever, at Pearl Harbor?
I don't really deal with the Pacific Theater very much.
To get the Americans into it? That would be a real moral dilemma for the wizard. It's only a throw out. You've got five more books.
You'll keep you busy for a while. But then again, the British actually did make that decision. They had broken the Enigma Code. They knew that one of the major cities was going to be bombed into non-existence, but rather than give up the fact that we knew what the Germans were doing, we let it happen.
Yeah. Was it Coventry?
That's it.
Coventry, yeah.
Which is interesting, because that sort of brings us to one of the themes. According to the description of this panel... Am I taking us off track?
No, go for it.
The description that we were given here is, wars in speculative settings are often presented as inescapable and morally unambiguous. It's hard to be a pacifist when the enemy is a group of vampires or aliens bent on human extinction. what can be done in military settings that can't be done in civilian ones? And how do we make space for pacifism and critiques of militarism, as well as battlefield action and military strategy? In other words, how do we find that balance, you know, for different points of view, while still maintaining a sense of drama?
Oh, so that's what this panel's about.
In theory. Or it could just be about, you know, whatever.
We could talk about your trilogy.
Which I haven't written yet.
For an hour.
I'm low. Yeah.
Well, we can start off with the basics. Well, what is peace versus war? America has been in a shooting war for the last, since 91. But is it, in fact, a war? We have had no formal declaration. Our men are out on the front field, my son specifically. But yet, it's not a war. So where is the boundary? When is a nation at war versus just peace?
Well, we haven't actually declared war since the Second World War.
There's actually
a line, if you ever saw the movie Wag the Dog.
Yes.
With Robert De Niro, and there's a scene where he's saying to somebody, I think it's Dennis Leary, as they're planning their fictional war in Albania. He says, and Dennis Leary says, so we're declaring war? No, we haven't declared war since the Second World War. We're going to war. Mm. That's different. We're going to war. Oh, we're going to war. Mm-hmm.
Also, to confuse matters, the word peace means different things to different people. In a democracy or a free society, peace means the absence of conflict, the absence of fear. In a totalitarianism, peace means the absence of opposition. Hmm. So you can be talking from their own people as well as the outside.
Yeah.
So you can have two sides talking about peace, and they both mean something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in that latter case, it's order at all costs, and that's the piece that's sort of provided as a result. I'm always interested, to me, in the sort of the macro versus the micro levels of how war is portrayed, and how that can get back to that critique that you were talking about as well. Yeah. So if you look at a global book, I'll move outside of fantasy for a moment, but you look at a book like War and Peace, which I'm sure you've all looked at it. Whether you've read it is another matter. But, you know, which is very much chessboard, right? You know, looking at the large sweep, the epic scale of large groups moving in this area. And there are, at times, kind of individual foci, but it's not the overall focus of the book. The book is very much about sort of global movements, right? And if you think in fantasy, Tolkien probably moves in that direction quite a bit as well, often very well, I think, actually, being able to present the sense that there is something very large going on with large groups. But when you get to those moments, there is not nearly as much of a critique of militarism because it's so distant. You know, the sense is that we're watching these groups move here, and let's watch the colors on the map change as such, you know, group takes over territory or gives it up.
Battleships across the board.
Exactly. But you don't get this sense of sort of diving into what's actually happening on the ground. On the other hand, if you look at work like, to go to science fiction, The Forever War, which is a vicious critique of militarism in many ways, precisely because you see what's happening on the ground all the time. And from the point of view of Haldeman, of course, who was in the Vietnam War, as everybody knows, when you're in the actual combat and when you're actually fighting, you have no sense most of the time of the large colors shifting, you know, territories, right? Your sense is, am I going to survive today? Help the guy next to me perhaps survive today? What am I going to do to the guy on the other side? And so that chaos that you get sort of on the surface creates this sense that, you know, what are we doing? You know, what is actually going on the ground? It's not this pleasant, we all sip tea in a tent and then send the troops out, chap, and let's see what happens. It's very much sort of in your face. So to me, the critique often happens based on the scale. I'll jump outside for fantasy again just for a moment to say that this is what happens in The Red Badge of Courage also. I think Crane can criticize militarism without specifically criticizing one side versus the other. That's not really relevant. But if you watch what Henry goes through, he's a kid, he's 14 years old. If you watch what a kid like Henry goes through on the ground, and Crane knew this because he interviewed Civil War veterans who had fought in that war, that experience of what they went through, no person, no human being should be expected to go through at any time. So there's a vicious critique based on the smaller scale of what's happening.
Well, absolutely. But you got to keep in mind, we don't go to war against other people. We go to war against the enemy.
Right.
It's us.
Right.
It's them. Once you change that mindset into they're no longer people like you, but a thing that needs to be stopped, you can do all sorts of incredible things that you normally wouldn't do in everyday life.
Yep.
Which is why you call them the krauts and the gooks and the chinks.
Anything to dehumanize the enemy, anything to depersonalize them.
Yep.
I mean, there's a great quote on this by Aldous Huxley. The most shocking fact about war is that its victims and its instruments are individual human beings, and that these individual beings are condemned by the monstrous conventions of politics to murder or be murdered in quarrels not their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've always been struck by that quote.
In fact, I was kicked off a jury for that. the defense started out with the basic concept of, would a sane man do this? Would he commit such an action? I just started giggling hysterically. It's like, my father was a great man, but he would climb into his bomber in World War II and kill hundreds of people he'll never meet, and he was a decent, God-fearing man. And I just started giggling, and the judge said, go away.
I remember a Bill Malden World War II cartoon of Willie and Joe sitting around, and one of them saying, the hell, this ain't the most important foxhole in the world. I'm in it.
Yeah.
So there's
right.
your focus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, the problem, of course, being that it only takes one side to make war, or one side to start a war, and then you have your choice of capitulation or fighting back.
Right.
And you also have the knotty problem of, what if a weaker person is being beat up on, you are not, do you go in, what's your moral responsibility, do you have one?
Yep. Right.
And it complicated even more by the fact the guy's making the decision of, we will go help out this person who's getting beat up by the bully, are not the ones who actually go off and take on the bully.
Right. Exactly. It's not as if we could just send our elected leaders and let them go and fight the cage match.
That would be great. Now,
wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
I think that the ratings for that would be fabulous.
Only if the other side did the same thing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you mow down, you have to get a whole new group of...
I'm just picturing, you got Obama and Putin. They're both in boxing shorts, kind of dancing around, sting like a butterfly,
I think Putin's in better shape, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the problem. That would be a sad, sad sign.
Never bet on the white guy.
Oh.
That would be the only time.
But, of course, that's the unfortunate irony, right, of calling the United Nations peacekeepers. Yeah. What does it mean to actually prevent people from being killed? It presumably means you have to fire back at some point, right? There's no way to just leap in front of bullets. You've got to become, therefore, part of the conflict. And then it's very difficult to keep that conflict from spiraling over. Even practically, it's difficult to keep that conflict spiraling over. The idea of having a sort of limited theater of operations and we only go so far and then not go any farther is extraordinarily difficult, right?
Yeah. I mean, and even if you start out as a peacekeeper, eventually a peacekeeper can turn into a belligerent.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was one of the recurring motifs in Farscape. They have this whole civilization called the Peacekeepers, who eventually become totalitarian overlords.
Yep.
But then as the series progresses, you see they are standing against a worse people, the Skarrans. Mm-hmm. So again, we're now kicking from our black-hatted bad guys. Suddenly it's ambiguous.
Right.
Are they the bad guys or are they protecting against something worse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the fun is the wrong word, but a lot of the challenge of writing war stuff is to look at these things. What are the
moral implications?
Yeah, the whole idea of a preemptive strike. Well, you're not being attacked yet, but some of your buddies are. What are the ethics of that?
Yeah, it's all about moving past binary good versus evil into shades of gray.
And there are no easy answers, and it's a case-by-case thing, and good people will have honestly opposing opinions.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's like the Bosnian War. Russia's providing arms to the Serbians, but then suddenly the UN decides to create a peacekeeping force. So the Russians painted the I-4 symbol on their tanks and came in to the conflict zone as UN peacekeepers. Mm-hmm. It was completely illogical.
And surreal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So who are the good guys, who are the bad guys? And you certainly can use peace to your own advantage to gain territory.
And there's a lot of history involved as well. I remember a lot of people dumping on, we gave weapons to the Iraqis and now they're using them again. Well, at the time, Iran was a bigger threat and Iraq was what was standing in their way.
Yeah, that was the Mujahideen.
Yeah.
Actually, that was in Afghanistan.
The war goes all the way back there, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, the point is today's ally may be tomorrow's enemy and vice versa, and you have to look at the balance. It's very much... sadly, like a real game of Risk. You have to make your alliances where they are. Well, we should not have gotten rid of Saddam. He knew how to keep control. Well, he'd invaded two other countries. He'd gassed his own people. And he'd thrown missiles at a non-combatant, Israel. The guy was dangerous. Maybe taking him out was not the best thing for the region. But then you could point out Iraq, which shouldn't have been put together the way it was after World War I anyway.
Right.
All these things tangle into it. And you have a different story if you are the commander or the general or the politician making these decisions rather than the ones on the ground.
Who's well, I mean, it's always easy to Monday morning quarterback or, or a quarterback from, you know, three decades down the line and go back and say, well, you know, but, you know, Iran was the greatest thing. Yes, but Iran was the greatest thing because in 1953 we toppled their democratically elected and secular government. We imposed, you know, the Shah on them for our oil interests with Britain. And then eventually the Islamic Revolution knocked him out, and that's why they hated us so much.
And ever
it's
since
like it's easy to go back and say, well, it all goes back to 1953, and then you've got the Mujahideen. Well, why did we arm the Mujahideen? Well, because they were killing Russians in Afghanistan, and that made us laugh. And we thought that was great. And then
because we didn't want the Russians pulling into going into Iran
and getting the oil.
All the oil and everything.
So we basically armed the Mujahideen as a bulwark against them. And but then once they got the Russians out, rather than do anything to help the Mujahideen, we said, and you're on your own. And then, of course, they turned on us.
And so of course, the question is, we did this. Well, I didn't do this. Nobody who's running the country now did this.
No.
When you say we, it's people before us, and so...
Well, there actually is, believe it or not, a lot of continuity in the defense establishment, military-industrial complex, and specifically in the State Department and Department of Defense. There are a lot of people who've been there for decades as policymakers or people influencing policy. So there actually is some continuity.
All right, we'll
not going back to 1953, obviously. But going back to, let's say, you know, 90s.
Sure,
definitely.
And so we end up lurching, you know, from sort of reacting from situation to situation. My frustration with this is, and my frustration with this is that it ought to be clear to us at this point that we are extraordinarily, we being everybody who engages in this, regardless of country or nationality, we are extraordinarily short-sighted in being able to figure out what's going to happen 2 years down the road, let alone a decade from now. You'd think we'd put some effort into figuring that out. I mean, whether a specific individual, because that's what happens, right, is we justify each individual specific decision as we did this for this reason, then this for this reason, and it all makes sense at the time, but as we all agree, you look back 5-10 years later and say it made no sense in the overall regional kind of, you know, conditions and circumstances that were there, which means even if you got that decision wrong, you could start putting in some kind of process where you're going to mess this up and mess this up, but long term, you're going to have a sense of what's going on rather than always fighting the war that's in front of you, literally right in front of you, without thinking about the larger context.
But there are so many wild cards that you don't anticipate. You're going to have strong men running Egypt and, you know, Saudi Arabia and Syria forever. Well, it didn't happen. And the rebellion, would we really expect a rebellion to take over some of them, you know, topple some of these strong men? I mean, they've been there for decades.
Right.
Should we assume? I mean, I'm sure the military planners have contingencies for everything, but the politicians, which path are we going to actually go down? It's really hard to anticipate.
Yeah,
so.
That's true. But I guess you can do the best you can. I do think sometimes they kind of jettison that idea, and they're just kind of like, here's what I need, you know, at the moment, at this second, and that.
It's politically viable right now.
Right.
And part of the problem is we reelect everybody every 2 years or 6 years or 4 years.
So there is no sense of...
And the purpose of politicians these days is get reelected, which means you do keep kicking the can down the road as much as you can so that you keep looking good.
Yeah.
Sadly enough... That goes against any kind of long-term plan.
Yeah, you're right.
So listening to all of your opinions and the knowledge that you have of global political dynamics, so do you use your writing then to fix what you think needs fixing? Is that what you find you do in your writing, since you all love war?
Let's rephrase.
Yeah, wait a minute.
Shall we?
Let me rephrase that slightly. I think it's an excellent question. I would say I don't try to fix it. I do try to highlight it. I think our job as writers is to demonstrate circumstances that are deeply problematic, and other circumstances it might not be, but our job is to highlight circumstances in our own world, and the context of what we write needs to function, for me anyway, not just as a story, but as something which may therefore have resonance back in the world in which we live, right? So that, I mentioned Haldeman's Forever War a little while ago, you know, that was his personal experience in the Vietnam War brought to an alien planet. And a lot of what he was talking about in The Alien Planet and the insanity of what he goes through is, of course, made to make us think about what is it that we send our, you know, our you know, men and women into when we get involved in these conflicts and we're making these decisions in our case, Washington, D.C., and we're sending people off to fight in, you know, a jungle in Vietnam? What are the impact not only on us, what's the impact on the people that we kill? Something which Haldeman talks a little bit about, too. So in my own work, I try to highlight that to a degree that I can. One of the nicest comments I ever got about The Third Sign was a reader who sent me an email and thanked me for having thought about the consequences of war after the fact. You know, it's nice when everyone has the parades and the confetti falls and all that stuff, but what happens to the people who are left on the ground? What are the impacts on the civilian population? What is the impact of people trying to rebuild after those circumstances? There have been occasional wars where we did vaguely better on that, but in general, most of the time, once the people march away, you deal with landmines, literally and figuratively, for decades afterwards. So I think it's beyond any of us to be able to fix it in a book. Yeah. I do think, however, it is, in my view, a responsibility to highlight it, regardless of our personal opinions about this or that conflict. If you avoid it, if you pretend that it's just large colors going over large colors, I think you're doing a disservice. So I think you have to highlight it, maybe not fix it for me.
Well, I stay in the macro level. Basically, I'm dealing with what we call under the helmet perspective. I'm dealing with the human cost of being a soldier in war, so I don't mess with the bigger picture.
I tend to look at bigger picture when I'm incorporating elements of war or politics into, let's say, a Star Trek book. But obviously the needs change based on what kind of story one is trying to tell, and also what genre or what franchise you're working on. For instance, when one is working in Star Trek, there is a certain set of givens. There's a philosophy that underpins storytelling in Star Trek that makes a story a Star Trek story. So you can't tell the same kind of war story in a Star Trek setting that you might tell if you were writing, say, a book based on 24. You're going to have a very different outlook, a very different attitude. And I say this as someone who just wrote a 24 book for Tor, which will be out this fall. So when I wrote the 24 book, you know, it's very much grounded in real-world politics. It's Jack Bauer on the ground in Somalia as a rogue actor, sometime circa 2012. He's dealing with, you know, the collapse of the, you know, Somali state. He's got warlords. He's got gun runners. He's got al-Shabaab militant Islamic cells. There's loose nukes on the ground. There's politics between the Russians, the Yemenis, the Somalis. I mean, everybody's involved, and everybody's coming down on this poor Jack who's caught in the middle.
Why can't I have just one good day?
Right. Every damn day. I never get to poop.
A bunch of bad days.
This poor middle-aged man running around never finds a bathroom. But anyway.
He's had a lousy month if those were all consecutive days. You know what I mean?
That's how we try to spread them out. Know, yeah. I just want to tell him to go, again? Again? Anyway, but in Star Trek, like two different examples. In 2004, one of my first two Star Trek novels that I ever wrote for paperback, what was called A Time to Heal, and I wrote it right as the 2003 U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq was underway. And I had quite a few strong opinions about that at the time, and I incorporated many of them into that book. Basically, A Time to Heal was paired with another book called A Time to Kill, which I also wrote. A Time to Kill was the invasion. It's a fast, Clancy-esque thriller. Happens, you know, in record time. Our heroes have to conquer a planet before the Klingons do to keep some information under wraps so that not everything explodes and not everything comes down into war. The problem is, then, in A Time to Heal, they have to occupy the planet. And as a result, these two books, although they're paired up as, you know, a duology, as a two-part story, they're very different. One is lightning-fast military action-adventure, and then the other one is the brutal, miserable slog of occupation and all the moral ambiguity that comes with it as you're dealing with resistance fighters, terrorist bombings. It's like there's scenes where I let you spend, you know, the previous book getting to know all the little peripheral characters who work, security officers, engineers, scientists, and there's one scene where a bunch of them are having lunch in a plaza in the second book, and they just get vaporized by somebody with a suitcase bomb, and they're just gone. So that was sort of a very brutal take where I was taking what I was seeing in the news, and I translated it into Star Trek to say, you know, how would a more, let's say, advanced or more peaceful or less militaristic society of the future view the kind of circumstances we're dealing with, and how would it comment on it? Very different example, a few years later I wrote the Star Trek Destiny trilogy, which was, you know, the Borg finally come in force with 7,000 cubes. They're not looking to assimilate, they're looking to exterminate. They're sick of us, we've resisted them too many times, we've done too much damage. Clearly, we're not worth assimilating. We should just be knocked out of play. And anybody who happens to be our neighbor, they'll just send them with us. The story is eventually resolved in what a lot of fans say is a very Star Trek fashion, which is the realization that the Borg don't need to be defeated. They need to be saved. The Borg drones, the trillions and trillions of drones, were all pressed into service. They're all slaves. None of them are willing combatants. They're all just tools. And every time we're slaughtering them and wiping them out in all these battles and destroying all these cubes, we're killing slaves. We're not killing the thing that's driving them. We're not dealing with the root problem. We're killing the people who are being forced to come at us, whether they like it or not. And so our heroes eventually figure out the key to this isn't going to be won through force of arms. We're going to win through force of ideas, which I thought was a very Star Trek idea. We're going to find a compassionate solution. We're going to save them rather than destroy them. So, I mean, that was what I thought was a very Star Trek commentary on the struggle between war and peace. On the one hand, the Federation is at the brink. They want to survive. They're being pushed to the absolute limit. At the same time, they don't want to sacrifice all their ideals and all their principles in the name of survival, because at that point, once you've sacrificed all the principles you claim to defend, what are you defending at that point? Just existence? What have you become at that point? So, for in the sake of a Star Trek story, I wanted to be able to take that route of saying, it's more, you can't just survive. At some point, you've got to actually be fighting for something, not just against something.
Let me just make a quick side comment about that. When I teach science fiction in the fall to my students, one of the things I talk about are these major threads that we get in science fiction of the largely apocalyptic, depressing, we're all going to die, the sort of stunning new vision of the future, which I find difficult to believe is actually new anymore since we hear it all the time. Okay? Like, really, how many apocalypse stories can you have that's still new? And then you've got the other thread, and I often wonder where we in the genre would be if you didn't have that extraordinary optimism that you get from the sort of Star Trek take. And I don't say that in any way facetiously. I think if you don't have that, you end up having this extraordinarily dark, depressing genre of fiction that also doesn't highlight hope, right, or the possibilities of getting beyond it. And so I was thinking about, as you were saying it, if it weren't Star Trek attached to the name, I could imagine a lot of people being like, come on, like, we know the real Federation, the way they would actually do it is they just build up their military budget and blow them to hell and laugh and smoke cigars in the, right? I mean, that's the sort of, that would be the cynical approach, but because we attach properly, I think, a certain veneration to the Star Trek name, that story ends up being sort of inspiring to a degree. It's hopeful. Well, so I just wanted to point out that for my students anyway, who are not, you know, genre folks to begin with, they really, really, really appreciate, because I teach Star Trek as, you know, one of the weeks is actually spent talking about a couple of the original series episodes, they appreciate the somewhat lighter bent, you know, that's given to them from an honest established franchise, so they can say, okay, not everyone's going to die all the time in every book that's written in this genre. So I don't know, I appreciate the more compassionate approach that Star Trek gives us.
Well, the one interesting thing that connects both, say, the dystopian trend that you were talking about in Star Trek, is they both do proceed from one shared assumption, which is that it's about free will. We can either choose to go down a dystopian path by not correcting what we're doing.
Right.
Star Trek is basically posited on the idea we can choose to be better than we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, we haven't done it so far. That doesn't mean we can't at some point wake up and say, this is not working for us anymore. We can choose to be better. And Star Trek is basically about a future that says, what if one day we just decided as a people, as a species, we're going to be better than we are. We can be better than this. Let's be better than this.
I will point out one other assumption you're making in this whole, let's say, these Borg drones and such. There is a hidden assumption is that everybody wants the same things. And that may or may not be true. You can have a group of people who say, our life here is terrible. We have been promised an afterlife that is much better if we go and slaughter innocents. And that is their way of thinking. And can you persuade them otherwise? I'm not saying we can't. I'm just saying there's a hidden assumption there. And you can go either direction, get interesting stories out of it.
It's just that within the context of Star Trek and canon, what was established about the Borg doesn't support that reading of the theory. All the canon evidence regarding the Borg supports the theory that they force assimilation.
And I'm not saying the Star Trek one is necessarily wrong. I'm just saying, in the real world,
if
you assume everybody wants the same thing, and that's not necessarily true.
Yeah,
the
I just had to proceed from what I was getting.
No, I understand, but I'm just saying that that's another aspect of the war story.
Oh, yeah.
And the another one, just to toss in with your occupation of the planet, what if the planet is happy to have you here?
Well, the idea is that some people were, some people weren't.
Well, what I've heard, the majority of the Iraqis were glad we were there because we were keeping down all of the sectarian conflict and everything. And my evidence is there were no 100,000 people marches against the American occupation because we would have seen it all on CNN. So clearly a lot of other people, a lot of people didn't like it. We had the terrorists and everything like that. But a lot of the common people, I think, were just as happy that somebody was sitting on...
I think they were happy because we were giving the insurgents something to shoot at other than them.
Yeah, happy we for were, whatever reason.
Look at the wonderful Americans with the targets on their backs.
For whatever reason, it was
we took
not,
the heat off them for a little
and
bit.
And it was not, yeah, because of the, it, as I said, keeping down the sectarian violence type of thing. So it, all of this stuff, when you start digging the layers of conflict and war, starts getting really complicated, and you've got all these options, all these parameters, and as a writer, you can tweak as to how you want to do them.
Which gets us back to scale, by the way, because, again, if you're talking about sort of avoiding the kind of monolithic, everyone will react this way to something, the Borg, the benefit of the Borg is they will do that because they're monolithic because they're the Borg. Right. It's very convenient, you know, so everybody thinks this way. But in general, as you point out, of course, that's not the way that individual actors are. Individual human actors are going to act differently. And so that's where you get into the scale. If you're looking at them above the chessboard, a pawn is a pawn, and a pawn moves two spaces forward at the beginning of the game and one space otherwise and captures diagonally. But if you were in the position of the pawn, you would presumably look at things much differently, and you would be different than the pawn next to you. So it gets back a little bit then to scale and who we're focusing on to know what their motivations are, the commanders, who will be very different and, of course, will be different than what the individual, you know, soldier is going to be.
And you can have the Iraqi government and the U.S. occupiers having one point of view, but all these little tribal chieftains who are very powerful in their region have their own motivation, their own thing. You negotiate with them. Some are going to definitely be on your side, some are going to be against you, and the whole thing is becomes a mosaic rather than, as you say, the monolithic.
When Yugoslavia broke down, the breakdown of Yugoslavia, people were a little bit surprised initially about the conflict, the regional conflicts that erupted, and they said Yugoslavia had been a very stable country. Well, yeah, because they had been they had been fighting each other until the Soviets went ding, and then for a five-decade period or so, you know, the Soviets are the, you know, the cop in town, and that's the common enemy, and also the common sort of governing force. When you take it away, the regional conflicts that had existed for centuries before the Russians got there didn't change. You know, they just take it away and they're like, well, now we get to fight again. It's like they're in static, you know.
Just reading about the Balkans War in World War II, they were fighting each other as much as they were fighting the Germans.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, that's a good point. A lot of, in not just the Soviet Empire, but the Roman Empire, the Mongol Empire, a lot of these towns have been fighting forever. Not now, because we are going to sit on you and one of you guys starts, you know, ruining the tax base of the other guy, we're going to stomp you because we're getting our tribute.
But that gets taken away.
You guys are fighting a little war, you're screwing up the trade route that happens to that town.
The Pax Romana, and like, a lot of people...
Knock it off!
A lot of people had their best eras of peace under somebody else's rule.
Yeah, sadly enough. Yeah, that's true.
Don't make my legionnaires come back there!
You go to this corner of the country. You go to this corner of the country and think about
leave each other alone. Yeah, right.
So the situation today in the world is when you look at superpowers, and especially us with America, right? There really is nobody that's going to face us in unlimited warfare. I don't mean nuclear warfare, but I mean even conventional warfare.
Yeah.
Our military is equal to the next 14 or 15 militaries in the world combined.
So you're faced with a situation where asymmetric warfare is the new norm and has been a long time.
Right.
What are your feelings about the... You say it only takes one to make war, but it doesn't take a large one to make war. It doesn't take a large country to make war against even a superpower today.
But
effective war, and ISIL is a very good example. They're doing a terrific job of publicity.
Oh, yeah,
there's a lot of perception involved. If you are the superpower and the bad guys are convinced you will come and stomp them if they start messing around, a lot of times they won't mess around. the idea of being you have to, but trying to get to just having the power is not enough. You have to can persuade them.
You have to be able to project force.
You're willing to willing and able to use it.
Of course, there's a difference between being willing and able to use it and knowing where you can use it. For instance, if you're dealing with a non-state actor, ISIS is not really a state actor. It's not like there's a particular piece of territory, a particular piece of land with defined borders and a capital and whatever, and that's ISIS, and if they screw with us, we just target a few missiles and we go, and you're done. Let's move in, pave it over, and start again. The problem is, they don't actually have a capital. They don't actually have land. There's no one site you can attack. They move around. They're nomadic. And the problem is that they're being sheltered in an area of the world where we don't have a lot of friends, or the friends we have are not exactly the best friends you could ask for.
Well,
and but some of that comes from perception, too. If we are show ourselves to be good friends and stable friends, we get more friends elsewhere. The United States is the major power. They will stand by our side. We will be more friendly, and we will feed them more information. And any kind of wishy-washiness coming out of Washington, any of throwing the allies under the bus or anything like that...
Suddenly they're not going to stick their neck out for you.
Absolutely, and why would they?
Right.
So,
if you're not going to have their back, why should they have ours?
Again, the perception is almost as important as the power itself.
Yeah, also relying on proportional response, though, and reaction is important, which a lot of these places like ISIS, a lot of these organizations like ISIS rely on, right, which is you have this, you know, series of very well-publicized killings, right, and very well-publicized apparent territorial moves, although on the ground, ISIS effectiveness, when put up against any actual military force, as proven by the Kurds, who destroyed them up and down, is demonstrated to be pretty weak. You know, they're not that powerful a force, honestly, but they are extremely good at getting people upset and angry at them, which, of course, is the point.
Propaganda agents more than
And what they want more than anything else is to have this overwhelming, you know, beyond proportional response from a large, massive superpower like, as you say, us, the only one that exists, so that they can then say, look at who we stand up and are equal to. We got these people in and so upset with us that they had to take steps to move forward. That, which is one of the reasons why it's so frustrating then to see the incredible, constant, repeated mistakes of overreacting to every one of these things, which on an individual level is clearly individual and tragic. I don't want to diminish that at all. But on the macro level, our overreaction makes it far worse and has for a century, our overreaction to every individual movement. And so to get back to your point about asymmetry, I think that's the problem, right? Asymmetry also implies asymmetry of proportionate response. If someone does something and punches someone else and your response is to punch them, kill them, blow up their house, destroy the neighborhood, and nuke the country just to be sure from orbit, because that's the only way to be certain, right? If that's what we do, then we have ensured that everyone else is going to say, boy, if you poke them just a little bit, maybe it'll keep them from messing around, but maybe it would also give them the sort of overall publicity and look at how scary we were to get the big bad United States involved. So I do think we need to take into account proportion of response as part of that kind of asymmetry too.
The problem is our entire military machine is geared for these big actions, shows, because we have a military-industrial complex that profits from that.
Oh, yeah.
The problem is, in a future where we're dealing with asymmetric warfare, small non-state actors, terrorist, highly mobile targets, our military and our intelligence apparatus aren't optimized for that. They're optimized still for the two-front, two-ocean war. Against who? Sweden and Togo? I mean, come on, there's nobody out there to fight with anymore.
Sweden has got some serious dinner. They come forward with their tennis players. They will. I mean, Sweden.
We're getting those IKEA cabinets, whether they like it or not.
But you're right. The image is that they, you know, they sort of, I have this image of a giant fighting, you know, a mouse, right? The mouse sort of pokes you, and the giant, you know, brings the big hammer. And by the time it comes down, the mouse has come around and hit you in the back of the ankle.
And then crush the entire village where the mouse
And it was just like, you know, but there'll be no more mice from that village. So that village will never bother anyone again. But, you know,
on the other hand, the underreaction of not doing anything is almost as bad because, look, we hit the United States.
And they're powerless to retaliate.
It's
that's
hard
where SEAL Team 6 gets involved.
It's hard to judge where you're going to be going.
I need just to comment on your not being prepared. I agree that we're not, but it's also true that the United States military today has over a division in manpower of trained special forces. They're well in excess of 10,000 people that have an investment of probably in the neighborhood of $1 million a person in training. There's never been anything like that in the
Well, that's the new mindset, do more with less. I mean, we have an all-volunteer army now, which is a damn good thing. So we have to pour more resources to each individual man because they're now expected to do the work of 10 or 20 other conventional forces.
A couple comments. One, the idea of fighting a war of ideas as opposed to war of arms. Speaking of ISIS, you have these, they're very mobile, they're very, you know, not stable even really. But then you end up with this idea, I like killing things. I live in Idaho, and I like killing things. Let me go to the Middle East and, yeah, I believe in Islam. You know, and so for the sole purpose of killing things. And so you get these other kinds of actors into a conflict for the own, because they like killing things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gives them the you know, the commendations, the oh, you're so wonderful because you can kill things so effectively, when they don't really care about the ideologies that are behind the conflict. And another thing about the response with Putin, nobody is going to stop me from taking back Ukraine. And you know, that's kind of his idea right now. And so with that show of power, and you have to be able to use the power, and are we as a non-Russian world, are we showing the power that we have that says, no, dude, you cannot be a bully?
I do want to say I agree on some of that, but I do want to point out also that this is getting slightly away from the war part, but I'll do it just temporarily, that there are other ways to demonstrate power that are not military and, in fact, are often far more effective. What you see now is a long-scale way of Putin trying to figure out what to do because he's being deserted by the plutocrats that put him in the position in the first place, and that's because the ruble has collapsed, and the reason the ruble has collapsed is because these sanctions that were very derided months ago when they were first put into place are working. And when Putin loses his power base, which, make no mistake, is not based on nationalistic fervor, but is based upon the plutocrats who say, as long as you can continue to make us money with these little forays into this country and that country, you can do what you do. I think that's going to have a much longer impact. So I agree that there, that sort of when you choose to deploy the power is important, and not just sort of sitting back and waiting while people do things to you is important. But I do think we need a much, much, much more diverse approach to how power then gets displayed. And I think, to go back to the Star Trek example, in part, it is a matter of not just winning the war as a hot war, not just winning the war based on the number of bullets you can fire, tanks you can deploy, missiles you can drop, planes you can fly, but the way that you can in some ways bring people into, for example, a more positive economic footing so that there are fewer people who are disenfranchised, poverty-stricken, and say, well, what the hell, I might as well go and fight because clearly I can't, you know, I'm going to die here just watching as, you know, my economy crumbles around me. For example, after World War II, the brilliance of the Marshall Plan, the brilliance of the Marshall Plan was that by pouring that amount of money in, by doing, in fact, the polar opposite of what was done after World War I, where it was designed to destroy the German economy and punish the people and crush them, and that led directly, as Woodrow Wilson said it would, as Woodrow Wilson said it would, it led directly to the rise of Hitler, who was, remember, elected. He didn't take over in a tank. He was elected, and Hindenburg gave him the key to the city in front of 100,000 screaming Berliners. He was elected because he told them, we are not going to let this happen to us again. The Marshall Plan after World War II did the exact opposite of that and actually invested money into the economy. So you have now a country which is stable, an ally, and I don't think anyone's worried that Germany is going to invade us anytime soon.
No.
That's an example of what happens when you deploy a different form of power. So I agree with you, but I do think that we as writers need to think about this too, and we do in our work, that it's not just power is defined as, and I'm not, I know you weren't saying this, but power is not defined as just how many bullets you can fire.
And one other important note about the Marshall Plan is that by investing in Germany and the whole of Europe the way we did, it wasn't necessarily about buying their favor for us. It was twofold. Yes, there was a certain amount of gratitude that comes with us, you know, being willing to step up and say, all right, your continent has been smashed to the ground, we're going to help you build it back up. But there's also the perception on our side of, we are now invested in this.
Right,
we
right.
Have a
we don't want to go in and blow up our
we
own.
We have a stake in your future, your stability, your peace.
Sure.
And I think that what we need is something on the equivalent of the Marshall Plan, but in other areas of the world.
I totally agree.
I think it worked once. I think we need to go there.
Totally agree.
Guy in the back.
We've talked a lot about war and the implications and the mechanisms, but we haven't talked much about peace.
It's boring to write about.
Isn't it always the way?
Talk about writing about peace.
is boring to write about.
Yeah.
But I mean, not, yeah.
Because where's one of the things you said was, how do we get the peace? What makes the peace peaceful? And
well,
several of you have written examples of it being at all costs. I think several of you have written examples of different things going on under the peace. And is it really peace at all?
Well, I mean, there's a great phrase, losing the peace, which is, you know, the problem with peace is that sometimes peace is merely that period between wars when you're trying to prevent war.
Right.
And it seems almost that it almost inevitably fails.
When you focus on the sort of, I know I keep coming back to scale, but when you focus on the sort of macro level of a society which appears to be peaceful, that would be pretty boring to write about. If it's like everyone got along with each other, and he also got along with him, and also she got along with him. Chapter two, the children also got along. This book is not going to sell people.
The dog and the cat got along.
They just were wonderful with each other. It was great. Let me tell you about the food they ate. But let me get back to the point of your question, though. All of those things are true. However, on every societal level, there is plenty of sort of material to mine of places where there is conflict below the surface. So, for example, we had Ann Leckie on the show, who wrote Ancillary Justice, of course, last year. Ancillary Justice does a very, very good job at the beginning of the book of showing a empire, a, you know, galaxy spanning empire, which appears on its surface to be peaceful. When you dive down into it, of course, you get what is essentially the Roman Empire, where peace looked to be on the surface there, and it was, you know, you didn't have massive conflicts erupting within the Roman Empire, but what you had were very, very many small, regional, you know, individual conflicts, small group conflicts that were often brutally put down, but sometimes not even, because the Roman Empire had to decide, do I really want to put all this effort into going after this small little thing? So there are these sort of small conflicts then that I think we can focus on very productively, set against the backdrop of this possibly imposed peace, right? So I would say that, so peace in general is not exciting to write about, but writing about the fault lines within the peace I think can be interesting.
And you see that in the original Star Trek. I mean, even going back to the 60s series where you have Roddenberry's vision of a peaceful, almost utopian future, even then the Federation still struggled with the ability to maintain peace. They were always being pushed to the edge of war. The Klingons were always encroaching on territory. There were always planets within the Federation with whom you had to make devil's bargains.
Yep, yep.
And there was constantly this struggle to maintain the peace and keep war from the door.
Yep.
So I think that...
And if you want a peaceful society, I mean, the traditional, the way I was taught, the traditional conflicts are man versus man versus nature, man versus himself. So you can have a nice, peaceful society, no war, and have someone conflicted with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can do man versus nature type thing, which I argue, by the way, Terminator is. The Terminators are a force of nature rather than an enemy, because they are, it's like fighting a hurricane. You cannot reason, whatever.
Until it goes back to the past, and that's man versus...
Well, in a sense, that's what the Borg represent. The Borg are not so much another...
They're almost a force of nature
Well, yeah, they're imposed by Q.
It's a disaster.
I mean, like, they're brought as an external
disaster.
Force as a test, right, initially, right? I mean,
he doesn't bring them to... He presents Picard to them because he thinks Picard's being a bit of an...
Either way, but he sort of confronts it with an existential threat.
He says, I want you to see what's out there.
Yeah.
Of course, by doing so, he accelerates
the inevitable
meeting.
Right.
So anyway, you can if you want a peaceful society to write about, you write about the conflicts... interpersonal or internal of their characters. So you don't have to have war. It's just that war, man versus man, is one of the easiest ones to set up and show.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's an old saying that American novel, boy meets girl, boy gets girl. French novel, boy and girl get each other at the beginning and then don't want each other. Russian novel, boy never gets girl, and for 800 pages they brood about it. So the man versus...
Girl throws self under train.
The man versus himself can be tricky to do without becoming a Russian novel. So the war is easier
Greek
to...
Greek novel, play. No girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. Low-hanging fruit, David.
Corner of the country.
Low-hanging fruit. It's low-hanging fruit. I get... You've had your hand up for once.
I actually, mostly, I have a question for Michael, because he said he did a lot of under the helmet.
Right.
Macro level stuff. So
you're right about what you know.
Mostly aimed at him, because I was thinking, one of the things I haven't seen, but I did something similar in my own book, but I'm not writing about the soldiers, is it would be very interesting to have a military science fiction novel that alternates points of view between soldiers on each side.
Hmm.
Is this anything you've ever attempted, considered, or heard of anyone who tried? Or
My Conqueror's trilogy. First book is a human point of view. Second is from
the
alien Jir's point of view.
Yes.
And then the third one goes back and forth between them. And we're focusing on individual...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we're focusing on the Kavanaugh family and the Jir's family.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Thurgolog. So I'm doing the massive sort of thing, but I've got individual focal points. But yeah, the second book is from the alien point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And by the third book, you realize that this war that is starting is a complete mistake.
Yes.
And both of the families, both of the sides involved, realize it as well and are trying to get it stopped. So yeah, I've done the alien point of view.
I think that's a very good way of doing war and not having it turn into them versus them, and actually showing war doesn't do good things to anyone.
Oh, yeah.
No. I had the chance to interview a guy, Yon Fenice, from Ubisoft Montpellier. I run a Twitch TV channel where we talk about, shockingly, story and narrative in games. They did a game called Valiant Hearts, The Great War, which I recommend if you haven't had a chance to see it. It's about World War I, and it talks about, so you have several playable characters within it that are from different sides. You have a German, you have a French, and each of these individuals has their own story, which plays out over the course of the game. What was fascinating, for him it was, and for the entire group in Montpellier, it was a personal story, because they were talking to their grandmothers, their great-grandmothers, the people who had tintypes of, their husbands who fought in, the trenches. This is last year was the 100-year anniversary of World War I, and sort of talked about the experience of going through that. I found that was very striking, not just because the story was interesting, but because, of course, there with the game, you yourself take on the responsibility of acting for each of these individuals on each side, and you have a level where you're trying to get, German guy from point A to point B. You then turn around and have a French person who deals with the consequences of what the German person did in the previous level.
Yeah.
What then do they do? And I found that really fascinating. So there have been examples of that elsewhere, not just in books, too.
Very true. We've got about 1 minute, so time for anybody who's not asked a question has a question.
Yeah, in the second round.
Yeah.
So how about when exploring these nuances, differences between a human versus human enemy and human versus a non-human, not even expressing human characteristics?
Two quick examples. One, Ender's Game, where that's talked about in great detail and depth, to a lesser degree, Speaker for the Dead afterwards, but both of those deal with that subject. And then the second example, which I went back to, which I'll go back to again, is in Haldeman's Forever War, where you begin to find out aspects later on of the alien society. You never get quite into their heads, but you definitely get this sense later on that they didn't even know they were fighting a war with us. We thought we were fighting a war with them. They had no idea what was going on. We couldn't communicate with them. And so as a consequence, there was this tragic back and forth battle for centuries that didn't need to exist in the first place, largely because of differences between the human construct and the alien construct. So those are two examples.
Go ahead.
Cool. I was going to point out, you're talking about peace and the aftermath of war and occupation, that sort of thing. I think Firefly ended really interestingly with the Alliance versus the
Browncoats
and all the little colony worlds that they had spent all the resources to settle. And why are they so picky about having self-determination? Where did all this come from?
Oh, that was the interesting ideas of
We're on the losing side. I don't think it was necessary.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. That was fun.
It was a good time.